Welcome back to the third episode of The Bronx Beat. My name is Ryan Garcia, and I'm joined, as always, by Gary Phillips, beat writer for the New York Daily News, covering the New York Yankees. Paul Goldschmidt has returned on a one-year, $4 million contract. Camp opening up this week. We're going to have some actual spring training things to talk about, some actual tangible things, and Gary will be down there. We'll get into what that looks like from a reporter's standpoint as Gary gets ready for the season to begin. We'll get into your questions, the mailbag, and we'll get into all that and more right here in this video. If you're listening on Apple and Spotify, give us a five-star rating and download as well. If you're watching on YouTube, like, subscribe, turn on that notification bell so you can support the page, and we'd really appreciate it. And without further ado, Gary, how are we doing today, man?
I'm doing great. It's my last day up here in the cold in New York, flying down to Tampa tomorrow. So I know it's a little on the chillier side down there still, but I'm looking forward to it being, you know, closer to 70s and 75 than what we're dealing with right here.
It's all about the upgrades, right? It's all about going from 2 degrees to a retired Yankee jersey number to actual above freezing temperatures. It's kind of nice to, I have to imagine it for now. I have another month until I'm in anything resembling warm weather. Gary, I don't know if you watched the Super Bowl. My little brother is a very happy man today. They just walloped the Patriots. And I mean, I was holding my breath the whole time, even though it was pretty boring of a game. Is there anything that stood out to you in that Super Bowl, man?
Not really, other than, yeah, it was kind of a boring Super Bowl. I am happy for Sam Darnold. I used to run a website about the Jets, so I was paid to watch many, many putrid Sam Darnold performances. So to see him be a Super Bowl champion, that's pretty cool, and, you know, pretty cool story. Gotta be happy for the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, dude, just what a boring Super Bowl. But I did enjoy the halftime show as a guy. Like, I'm repping my DR hat. I mean, it's World Baseball Classic time in my head. I haven't even, like, processed Yankee baseball yet. I'm at World Baseball Classic time, but I just enjoy getting together with family. So that's, I guess, one of the small perks. But Patriots defeated, crisis averted, Dynasty 2.0, dead, beautiful. That's what we love to get that's how I love to get my week started. But Gary, Paul Goldschmidt is back on a one-year, $4 million contract. The Yankees did end up bringing in a right-handed bench bat. What role do you foresee him playing on this roster, given the contract structure and kind of what initially Boone has said on radio so far?
Yeah, I know the question that fans have on top of their mind is, how is this going to impact Ben Rice? / is this going to cut into Ben Rice's at-bats? I don't think so. Based on what Boone has said all offseason, you know, the Yankees expect Rice to play more against left-handed pitchers than he did last year. That doesn't mean that Goldschmidt won't start at first base every once in a while against a really tough lefty, but the Yankees view Rice as a legitimate middle-of-the-order hitter. They want to see him against left-handed pitching more, so I still expect him to get those opportunities. Goldschmidt, I see being much, much more of a role player and even maybe more leaning towards a bench player than a platoon guy. You know, last year he was the starting first baseman at the beginning of the season. Then Rice kind of emerged and Stanton came back and Goldschmidt's performance kind of fell off a cliff in the second half, right? I would look at him as a bench bat. He will occasionally start against really talented left-handed pitchers. You can use him in pinch hitting situations, whether it be for Rice, Austin Wells, Ryan McMahon, you know, similar to how the Yankees might use Amed Rosario. And then he also provides some defense late in games if it's a close situation and you want to get Rice out of there. Before Goldschmidt had been re-signed, they didn't really have a clear-cut backup first baseman. It would have probably been Cody Bellinger. They were going to also experiment with Amed Rosario at first base this spring. Maybe he still does that, but I don't know that the need is necessarily there for Rosario now.
Yeah, and one thing you noted about Paul Goldschmidt and his ability to be a role player, he can pinch hit for anybody who's hitting from the left-handed side in these kinds of late-game scenarios. There were situations last year, I think of Seattle, where he comes off the bench and hits that home run, go-ahead home run off of Gabe Spire, I think is how you pronounce it. I'm not great with pronunciations, but I think there is going to be a level of utility for just, all right, we got a guy who can counter lefties off the bench. I do want to ask a little bit about the relationship between Ben Rice and Paul Goldschmidt. Goldschmidt is very respected around baseball. There were videos of him working with Ben Rice at first base, I think right before or during the postseason. Do you think that relationship and the ability for Goldschmidt to mentor Ben Rice played a role in them bringing him back?
I don't think it hurt. You know, Rice was very vocal throughout the season last year about how much Goldschmidt helped him. You saw it pretty much all year. I know the video you're referring to from prior to the postseason or during the postseason. I think I actually took one of those myself. I mean, Paul was out there with Ben constantly working on scoops, taking grounders together. Sometimes Paul wouldn't even be participating in the drills. He would be watching to the side as if he were actually were a coach and giving Rice real-time pointers on scoops and positioning, footwork, things like that. So that relationship's real. In general, Goldschmidt is considered a very well-respected leader. He has as good a reputation as anybody in the sport. I think that's been a constant throughout his three stops now in the major leagues. So Yankees are getting clubhouse presence. They're getting a mentor, a continued mentor for Ben Rice, and somebody who I don't think is going to eat into Rice's playing time or his at-bats all that much.
And in kind of keeping to the theme of taking away at-bats from other people potentially, I guess in case of Rice, not really, but guys like Jason Dominguez, Oswaldo Cabrera, players who have minor league options, are kind of on the bubble of the roster. Do you foresee this affecting their odds of making the big league team? And if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Goldschmidt in the fold now, you're looking at Dominguez or Cabrera possibly being on the outs and, you know, starting the season in AAA. And that's, you know, it could be both of them if the Yankees bring in a right-handed hitting outfielder, because right now, Dominguez is your fourth outfielder, and he's not a perfect fit for that role. He only plays left field. The Yankees have avoided playing him in center. They've never tried him in right. So right off the bat, he's limited defensively. Plus, he doesn't play a strong defensive left field. And on top of that, he's a switch hitter, but he hasn't shown that he can be a threat from the right side. So I'm not clear on what his role would be right now. Certainly not one that comes with any sort of consistent playing time. Maybe that changes if there's an injury. Giancarlo Stanton is always a candidate that could open up DH opportunities. Maybe you see Dominguez and a Paul Goldschmidt split that if Stanton goes down. But that's an if. That's not the current state of things, right? And then as for Cabrera, he's super versatile, but he doesn't give you the potential offensively that Dominguez might off the bench. The thing with Cabrera is that right now he's your backup shortstop because the Yankees don't want Rosario playing there. But I also want to see what his mobility looks like this spring coming off the ankle fracture.
Yeah, and I know the Yankees traded for another depth infielder, Max Schumann, who was DFA'd by the Athletics and can play some shortstop as well. So I do think the ability to play shortstop could give Cabrera the edge. I mean, they literally don't have a backup shortstop on the roster with Jose Caballero as a starter and Anthony Volpe on the IL. And for Dominguez and Goldschmidt, I view you're essentially swapping a one-position guy for another one-position guy, but this one-position guy can hit lefties and plays his position pretty well. At least the Yankees view him as playing the position well. I know some defensive metrics aren't high on Goldschmidt. Some of them don't really account for scoops. So I think that from a roster standpoint, Goldschmidt fits better than Jason, but we'll see how the season plays out. Goldschmidt is still a 39-year-old first baseman that can just kind of go like that. I mean, we've seen multiple mid-30s hitters have even great expected numbers and just completely collapse after. Now, the final question I have regarding this situation is, do you view this as the final move for the Yankee bench? I know you talked about maybe adding a right-handed outfielder. Do you foresee this as, okay, I think they're done here?
I think it's a little too soon to tell. Now, I think that might be dependent on what happens throughout spring training, how certain guys look in the early weeks of spring training. I'm not even necessarily talking about an injury or somebody getting hurt. But I did reach out to at least one person over the weekend, and after the Goldschmidt signing was like, hey, would this mean they're out on a outfielder, right-handed hitting outfielder? You know, has that been signaled to you in any sort of way? And the response I got was, I would assume so. Being that they are out on that type of player at the moment. That can change. There's a lot of time between now and opening day. Now, still some players out there, some veteran right-handed hitters who play the outfield. So maybe if the Yankees get the right deal and it falls in their laps, perhaps.
Yeah, and I know it got leaked. They made a 1 year, $1 million offer to Austin Slater, and he did not take said offer. That might kind of indicate the way they view these players, which is very cheap, very not going to throw significant money at these players, and I understand why. I mean, I this is no diss on Austin Slater or Randall Grichuk, but it's not like those two players have it's like those two players are going to get $10 million from a team or $12 million from a team. And for those two players, maybe starting every day somewhere makes more sense to them. I know we talked about this time and time again with bench guys. You can't just assume because you think they make sense as a bench piece that the rest of the league is only going to value them as a bench piece and that that player should only play a bench role. So there's, I imagine, a lot of moving parts here, and guys could always just get cut during spring training. I mean, Max Schumann got cut by the Athletics, and so the Yankees traded for him. That those things just kind of happen. Is there any final notes you have on this Goldschmidt signing addition or anything position player related?
The only other thing I would add is that I've seen a lot of fans speculating, oh, maybe now Rice becomes the backup catcher, you know, in a more traditional sense. And I would still think that's J.C. Ascara, so long as Ascara is on the roster. As of now, as far as catching goes with Ben Rice, I would still look at that as an infrequent thing, but a tool he's going to keep in his tool belt.
Yeah, and again, I think for Ascara, I mean, you just can't, you don't want to be put in a situation where Wells goes down and you have to start Rice in the middle of the fifth inning or something of the sort, because Rice just isn't the defensive catcher that the Yankees view, you know, tend to run out there. Do I expect, I know Boone mentioned that maybe he could get starts against a really tough lefty at catcher. Yes, but the regular season's also its own weird thing where the more you play Rice at catcher, the more days you have to give him off, the more it's going to beat up his body. So I think that's also something to kind of, I wonder how many games they'll play him at catcher. I think last year he got, he appeared in 36 games as a catcher, not saying he started or completed all those games at catcher, but that is just what Fangraphs has listed. So I'll be interested to see how many games he gets there. Now, Gary, you have a pretty eventful week coming up here. You'll be heading to Tampa. Camp is opening up this week for the Yankees. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it means on your end to get ready for this week? What is it on your side of things as a beat writer for the New York Daily News?
Yeah, so still got a pack. Going to finish doing that when we hang up here. I've procrastinated that to the last possible minute. But I will be flying down tomorrow. Tomorrow being Tuesday. Get down there, settle into the Airbnb that I am renting, and then on Wednesday I will be at George M. Steinbrenner Field in the morning and watching players kind of do their tunnel walk, and you know, some of them showing up for the first time, others have been down there in Tampa for a while. Boone is speaking later in the morning that day, so those will be his first remarks from spring training, and then yeah, it's off to the races. You know, we'll get our first pitchers and catchers workout the following day. Couple days later, position players report, then they have the full squad workout. So looking forward to it. Like I said, looking forward to being in the sun. And yeah, just it's a time to get to know new faces. It's time to introduce yourself to people, have more casual conversations. It's really the best time to be a reporter during the season if you're covering a baseball beat.
Now, can you compare this time of year at spring training to when the Grapefruit League games actually begin? Like what's kind of the day-to-day changes? What are some of the, I guess, conversational changes as well? I know you mentioned they're a little more relaxed now. Is there a stark difference between now and those Grapefruit League games beginning?
Not really. Like, the chillness of spring training tends to last throughout camp. You know, the only real difference once the Grapefruit League games begin is that there's games going on. They're not necessarily very important games sometimes. Like, you know, these games don't count, and sometimes the stats are inflated or misconstrued. We talked about that a lot on the last episode. But pretty much every day from the time pitchers and catchers report and have their first workout through the end of spring training, there's workouts always going on, whether there's a game that day or not. There's things happening on multiple fields at the complex at GMS. Guys are taking live batting practice, they're throwing live batting practice, working on different drills on the side fields. Everybody's kind of spread out and not together. It's really just on the game days. You know, those who are in big league camp are getting together in the dugout and they're playing, you know, nine innings in exhibition, and you know, some guys are getting one or two at-bats. Other guys are getting three or four at-bats. It changes throughout the spring. I wouldn't say much changes as far as the vibe once the games get started. It's pretty lax throughout.
Okay. You see, I'm curious because, again, I'm viewing this as a fan. I only see, you know, when the games begin and when they don't. I do think when it comes to the Grapefruit League games this year, I will be paying attention to who takes down Curtis Meade's reigning batting champion for the Grapefruit League at 524. I'm curious to see which hitter is going to beat that mark. Now, you did drop an article this morning on some of the storylines and questions you have going into spring training. Can you talk to us a little bit about putting together that article? I know you've talked a little bit before about having notes on each player, but can you kind of break down what the process of that article went, or what into that article? Boom.
Yeah, just some of the things that I'll be keeping an eye on, more bigger picture stuff. I mean, one of them being a look at this rather similar roster, which I think everybody now in the Yankees universe, whether it's a reporter or not, you know, or a fan, like, I think that point has been beaten to death at this point. Everybody understands what the conversation is, what the debate is. You know, the Yankees are running back a rather similar roster, debate the merits of that, so on and so forth. You know, we've covered that here on the pod. Another thing that I wrote that I'm looking for and gonna keep an eye out for is, you know, can this rotation avoid more injuries? Because as we've discussed, you know, they're one or two guys getting hurt away from having a Ryan Yarbrough or a Paul Blackburn in the rotation to open the season. So Max Fried, Cam Schlittler, Will Warren, they are all coming off of career-high workloads. Can they get through the spring healthy? Can Ryan Weathers and Luis Gil, who have been injury risk throughout their career, can they get through spring training healthy? Usually an injury or two pops up in the rotation every spring, or at least the early parts of the season. So definitely something to monitor, given that the Yankees did not add a significant piece to their rotation this offseason. Also wrote a little bit about the bullpen. I've been on the record saying I don't think it is good enough on paper right now. We'll see who emerges, who steps up and claims some jobs this spring. I know the Yankees have a couple guys that they're going to keep an eye on, a couple guys of intrigue beyond Bednar, Duvall, Cruz, Tim Hill, and that group. So we'll see if that works out for them or not. And then the other thing I wrote down was, you know, just keeping an eye on Jason Dominguez's outlook for the reasons that we just discussed.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to the pitching staff, I think that's where you're just going to have naturally, there's just going to be the most intrigue. We talked about this last week. We talked about spring training stats, where there's just more tangible things to look at with pitchers this time of year. You can see a new pitch. You can see some added or even decreased velocity. Sometimes that's the conversation as well. I think there's just way more information we get from pitchers and about where they're at than we do with hitters, because it's just way easier to figure out, again, hey, is this guy, like, is adding 2 miles per hour to your fastball good? Yes, obviously. Is, I don't know, opening your stance good? I don't know. We'll have to see. You have to play major league games for me to figure that out. I think with the bullpen specifically, that's where I just have the most questions about this roster. That's where I'm going to be paying the most attention to potential breakout guys. Cade Winquest is somebody you noted in this article. Probably the guy I'm going to be, is going to be not 1.1, but close to 1.1 on my board of people I'm looking at closely this spring. Gary, why do you think the bullpen's in the state it is right now in terms of, like, do you think they've left it, like, too unprotected? Do you think it's out of the realm of possibility that this group figures it out, or do you think it's just a gamble that could pay off for the Yankees?
I think it's a gamble that could pay off. I think it's a risky gamble to take if you are a team with championship aspirations like the Yankees. I think they're doing it because they do believe in their pitching development enough where they think, okay, if we bring in all these guys who are lottery tickets, like I've called them previously, then maybe some of them will pay out, right? Like, maybe a Cade Winquest does turn into a really good Rule 5 draft pick. Maybe somebody like Chavi, you know, they correct some things with him and that clicks right away. Maybe Brent Hedrick is ready for a bigger role this year and he's figured out the issues with his velocity fluctuating that he had last year. Now they think Jake Bird is better than the guy that they got a season ago. So we'll see. It's a lot of big ifs. It's not impossible that these guys pan out, but if I were the Yankees, I would have brought in a more established reliever at some point.
Yeah, and it's weird because I'm so used to them having really good bullpens, and the last few years it hasn't been the case where the bullpen's been I mean, arguably the best part of the team. I know in 2023, that team was not good in any respect offensively or on the pitching side, but the bullpen still was the shining point of that roster. There were points and times in 2021 where you could argue the bullpen was the MVP of that team. I'm baffled that the bullpen doesn't get more love, considering that used to be, or I'm not saying used to be in the sense that I don't think the organization doesn't care about their bullpen, but I think it's a little bit weird that it's this vulnerable given the pride they usually have had in bullpens. I mean, this goes back to, I mean, before all this, we had Mariano Rivera as the closer. So Mariano Rivera as the closer, obviously never going to be replicated in terms of in-game impact, but I think it's just weird that we've gone down this road of, oh, the Yankees don't have the safest bullpen in the world right now. Now, on the rotation side, I do think there's some intrigue here with what you talked about injury-wise, because some years you get just crushed with injuries, and other years it's a pretty safe spring training. Some of the safer years, 2022, they didn't have too many injuries. I think they actually avoided having any significant injuries. In 24, I know they lost Cole for a bit, but that was actually a pretty good injury-free spring training for the most part. Cole goes down, but you didn't lose him for the year, and then you keep everybody else. They have had kind of a weird trend of not typical opening day starters the last 2 years, and they've still found a way to be a pretty productive rotation. How do you feel about this rotation going into spring training? Is it similar to the bullpen? Do you feel higher or lower on it relative to the bullpen? Like, where are you at with that group?
I think it can be a really good rotation if they avoid more injuries and the guys that they get back from injury, you know, namely Carlos Rodon and Gerrit Cole, Clark Schmidt's expected back later in the season as a second half option. If those guys can come back and be themselves and pitch to their capabilities, and now the other guys can avoid injury this spring in the early part of the season, I think it's a really good rotation. I think it's a really deep rotation. I mean, it's more than five starters, right? Maybe then you start having some flexibility with the younger starters who are currently healthy, and you work them into your bullpen somehow if you need to. I think the rotation has the potential to be really, really good. I think the Yankees are banking on Gerrit Cole coming back and being Gerrit Cole. It's certainly possible that he can, right? Like, we've seen pitchers come back from Tommy John surgery in the past and been fine, if not better in some cases. Sometimes it does come with rust. You know, sometimes there is an adjustment period. So that's something I would watch out for when Gerrit is ready to come off the IL.
Yeah, and it seems Rodon is already in his throwing program. I know Aaron Boone mentioned on MLB Network Radio that he's in his throwing progression. They're not going to rush either pitcher. They want them to take their time, which I think is the right approach. You don't want to force a veteran starter to come back when they're not ready and then risk more serious injury. But I would agree. I think this rotation has the pieces to be good, whether they will or not. I mean, that has to, we have to let the games play out for that to unfold. But I think that's the case with most aspects of any team in baseball. You could make that argument for literally any rotation. I'd even argue the Dodger rotation. You could make the argument, well, if they don't get hurt is a big if. That's with every rotation. It's just pitching injuries are kind of random too. Gerrit Cole was like the beacon of stability for years, and now he's arguably the biggest question mark in the rotation in terms of upside versus downside of a 35-year-old who is very good when healthy, but is 35 years old and just tore his UCL. So I'm curious to see what this rotation ends up looking like. I'm curious to see what certain young guys look like coming out of their offseason programs, if they've worked on anything new. Is there any final thoughts you have on this piece? Because some of the things that we would talk about are questions people ask, so I didn't want to double up there.
Not really. No, I mean, at this point, I don't think there's any like huge questions or things that like people aren't thinking of when it comes to this team. A lot of the talk has been around bringing back the same or similar roster, the bullpen, a couple position battles, particularly in the bullpen at the end of the bench, like all things that we've talked about here already. No, I don't think so.
I will say, as a fellow, like I would consider myself a pretty darn good procrastinator. I support it, man. I support it. Procrastinating just means you're gonna get it done. It just means it's gonna happen. I don't think any of my professors are listening to this, but there are a lot of last second assignment doing, and some of them turn out really darn well. Again, I don't hope or I don't think any of my professors listen to Fireside Yankee, so I think I'm safe for the most part.
That's the approach I took to packing. So
It's the right approach. Look, man, it's going to get done, and you're going to be on your way, and you're going to have everything you need, because that's the way, that's how procrastinating works, man. It gets done. I think people forget that part of procrastinating. It ends up getting done anyways. But I think it's time for us to move on to our mailbag, because we have a good amount of questions from everybody, and we want to appreciate everybody who sends in questions. We're going to be focusing on three of them today, because a lot of them, there's either A, overlap, or B, we answered some of those last week. We will keep questions that are in the replies. We always keep tabs on them to see if we can insert them into a future episode, so don't be discouraged. We'll start with this first one from Drew Klugs, and it's semi-relevant to the conversation we just had about the rotation. Do you foresee Elmer Rodriguez being given a chance to earn a spot in the rotation over Heel in the World Baseball Classic?
I'm not after the World Baseball Classic. I think it's too early to say with that. In the Yankees' ideal world, Rodriguez is going to go to AAA and start the season in the minors and get a little more seasoning. You know, maybe if he has a really big spring and looks really sharp against major league competition, kind of like Luis Gil did a couple years ago, right, when he took Gerrit Cole's spot, maybe something like that happens. I don't know if it would necessarily be for Gil or if you would want Gil in the bullpen. You know, he's a bit erratic for that type of job. So I think maybe it would be more based on injury, but even then, you still have Yarbrough, you still have Paul Blackburn, and I think the Yankees want to see Rodriguez pitch at AAA a little more.
Yeah, I imagine this is a situation where Elmer would have to kind of force the Yankees' hand, and I don't think it would be over a healthy Luis Gil. I think it would be, as you mentioned, in an injury situation, kind of like how Luis Gil did 2 years ago, when in 2024... the Yankees optioned him about a week into spring training, and then he pitched so well that they literally could not ignore it. Gerrit Cole goes down, and he ends up being one of their five guys that they go into opening day with, but Elmer was further behind than Luis Gil. He had already made his major league debut, so I'm not sure I think we see Elmer in the big league roster start the year either. The next question comes from Zachary Goldstein, and he goes, why do the Yankees believe in their current bullpen? It got worse from last year, and they haven't done anything to address it. I know we talked about the bullpen a little bit, but Gary, from what you have gathered and from conversations you may have had with people and just your own intuition, what do you think the Yankees believe in their current bullpen from their perspective?
I think they believe in their pitching development. I think they believe in Matt Blake, who has a strong track record of finding diamonds in the rough. I think they believe in Sam Breen, you know, who, you know, you could describe the same way. You know, he's part of all these, you know, the Clay Holmes and the Luke Weaver decisions and those guys panning out. It's not just Matt doing things all by himself. You know, it's him, it's Preston Claiborne, it's Desi Drusciol, it's Sam Breen. Like, there's a whole department that goes into this that the Yankees have had success with in previous years, especially when it's these bargain bin types or these diamond in the roughs, lottery tickets, whatever you want to call them. Like, they have been able to do it. So I think the approach that they're taking and their mindset is, let's collect as many of these guys as we possibly can. There's a bunch on the 40-man roster. There's a few more coming as NRIs. Let's trust in the, you know, the experts that we have, the pitching department that we have, and let them do their thing and see where it takes us. Worst case scenario, if none of these guys look like they're going to be major league quality come mid-March, end of March, they could swing another deal for a more established reliever. You know, they can do the same thing if some of these guys make the team, you know, on opening day and they don't look good before the trade deadline, right? Like, you saw the Yankees overhaul their bullpen last year. So I think they're looking at it from the standpoint of, we have coaches and directors and player development people who are really good at molding these types of pitchers into contributors. Let's give them a chance to do that, and we can always correct course at a later date. As I've said, I don't think it's the best strategy for a championship aspiring ball club, but I think that would be how they're looking at it.
Yeah, and I think with all of the guys that we've looked at as either bubble guys or people they've brought in as these flyer types, there's usually an angle that you can go, yeah, I see how you turn this into a good reliever. The issue, of course, being for the most part, all these guys have a pretty unproven or not non-existent track record being a quality, reliable mid bullpen or high leverage bullpen arm. Cade Winquest is a double-A starter who will be asked to become a big league reliever. In the case of Paul Blackburn, he is a failed big league starter who has, or not failed big league starter, it's a little bit harsh. He's carved out a longer career than most big league starters, but he is a no longer viable every fifth day starter. Is that a good way to put it? I think that's a good way to put it.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, like a no longer viable guy who is trying out the bullpen gig. Jake Bird has always had the stuff, but he collapsed mid-year last year. Maybe that's workload. Maybe that's adjusting to being in a new ballpark and not pitching with the altitude. And even like the guys who are quote-unquote proven, Bednar, you've mentioned this before, 2 years removed from being optioned in AAA?
Starter last year, Pittsburgh sent him down.
And Doval, I think, was also optioned that same year, right? Am I not mistaken? I think 24?
I don't recall on Doval. But we know Doval can be extremely erratic, you know, very wild, has never had great command, even when he was good in 2023. Same thing with Cruz. He can be a bit all over the place, too. He's also been a bit injury prone, right? So there's a lot of question marks here. The one thing I will say is, like, if you look at all these flyer types that the Yankees have in their bullpen, like, there's at least one thing about each of them that you can say, oh, okay, I see what they might see here. I see what they might want to get out of this guy or think they can get out of this guy. I can see why they, you know, you always hear about the Yankees have like liked so-and-so for a while and then they get him, right? Like there's something with each of these guys where you could say like, I see what it is they like, or I see what it is they think they can mold. That does not mean it is going to happen.
Right, exactly. And you know, to kind of verify what I mentioned earlier, Doval did spend some time in AAA in 2024 alongside David Bednar. Well, not alongside, but in the same year as Bednar. So that's a cool... Is that a cool nugget? Is that just a stat nugget? I don't know. But as you mentioned, yeah, there's something to all of these guys, but there's also no track record for a lot of these guys. So we'll see how they end up panning out. But I do think the bullpen is going to be fascinating to watch in spring training, in the regular season. I'm fascinated. This is a nice, you know, this is a nice litmus test for a little like it's kind of a heat check for the player, pitching development. They get this right, man, and I think that's going to be a nice feather to put in their cap. Any final thoughts you have on the bullpen before we move on to our final question?
No, I think we've talked about it a lot. I think the only other thing is, you know, maybe when we get next time we get a chance to talk to Cashman in spring training, I think something I want to ask, and I'm sure other reporters do, is just why the Yankees have taken this approach to building their bullpen, but and looking at that from like both sides of the coin, right? Why the projects, and also why the aversion to spending on relievers? And I'd be curious to see what he says.
Yeah, and I hope that when people are listening to this conversation, they're not trying to hear this, and that they're not hearing this with the perspective that we're trying to make the Yankees agreeable. It's more so about being understandable, even if you don't agree with it. I think there's a big difference between understanding why something happens and agreeing that it happened. Why it happened, if it should happen, two very different conversations, but I think we've broken down a good bit as to why it is happening. And we'll move on to our final question here from John Shannon 6635. He asks, Jason Dominguez has played 124 games and 1,005 innings in the outfield for the Yankees. In that time, he has committed 3 errors. Why is he always described as a horrible outfielder? Gary, take it away, my man.
I mean, I've watched Jason Dominguez, right? Like, Yankees fans have watched Jason Dominguez. The Yankees have watched Jason Dominguez. You don't need errors or advanced metrics or anything like that to see that he has not been a good defensive outfielder. Teams are judging defense on so much more than just errors, and the reality is that Dominguez isn't getting to plenty of balls that he's even close enough where he should be close enough, but isn't in the vicinity that they don't even come up as errors. But if you look at some advanced metrics with Dominguez, you know, among all left fielders last year that played at least 700 innings, he led all of them with negative 10 outs above average, or I guess he trailed all of them, right? Like, he was the worst in that category. He was, I believe, the second worst in defensive run save. He was the second worst in fielding run value. And then again, if you just watch him, there's been plenty of instances where he doesn't get the right routes. He doesn't get the right reads. He has trouble going back on the ball. He loses the ball. I don't think you can look at him and his defense over the last few years and just say, oh, he's only made three errors. He's not that bad. I mean, he's has not passed the eye test, and he has not passed the metrics test, and that's why the Yankees don't view him as a center fielder either, right? Like, I think the Yankees have told you what they think of his defense thus far, or they've shown you, while they tell you something else sometimes, but I think they've shown you what they think of his defense.
I think this question is why we should take errors as a stat, as a way to assess defense, and take it, and I think you just throw it out. I don't believe in errors as a defensive stat. I've been loud and proud about it. There are really good defenders who make a lot of errors. There are really bad defenders who never make errors. I'm pretty sure Nick Castellanos is like multiple seasons without making errors in the outfield. He is one of the worst defensive corner outfielders you can watch in the modern game. I think Francisco Lindor makes double-digit errors every single year. Francisco Lindor is one of the best defensive shortstops I've ever seen. So I just don't like the stat errors. I hate it. I'll always hate it. And I will always push the narrative that it is a bad, bad stat for analyzing defense. And what you mentioned, like you just watched the games. I think defense is one of the components of baseball where, yeah, go watch some film. Like go watch film. There's data, there's advanced analytics if you don't have the time, but you can watch film. I think you can tell what is or is not a good defensive player. You watch Jason out there are plays he just does not make that you expect a big league outfielder to make. And as you mentioned with their actions, guys, the Yankees paid $55 million to two outfielders in 2026 to not play Jason Dominguez. $55 million. The Yankees are in unprecedented, uncharted financial territory when their owner has consistently stated it would obviously be advantageous to stay under $300 million. They've pushed to uncharted financial territory largely because they paid outfielders when Jason Dominguez is a pre-arbitration outfielder. That tells you everything you need to know. They don't think he's good out there. Whether they're wrong about his future development in the outfield, whether they're wrong about his future development offensively, and we could, I mean, he doesn't even, Jason could play Major League Baseball in 2027. I don't know. Injuries could open up. Stanton could end up playing 50 games this year, and Jason plays 100 games and looks good in those 100 games. Who knows? Point is, there's not really a world where you can look at Jason Dominguez in the outfield and expect anything other than what we've seen to this point without him making a massive development. Now, that doesn't mean, again, there's not a 100% chance he can't field this position, but there is a better than 50% chance, or there's a better chance than not, that he looks about as bad as he did last year defensively.
Yeah, and I don't want to say he can't become a good outfielder, right? Like, he's still, in a sense, learning left field. He still has not played a ton of professional baseball games. He is athletic, right? Like, there are tools there where you say, like, okay, he could become a good defensive outfielder. We have not seen that yet, and I think the Yankees have operated accordingly. The only other thing I would add on this subject, Jason works at his defense very hard. I don't know if fans have any perception of that or not, or if they think he's not trying out there to get better. Like, Dominguez last year spent a lot of time on his defense and getting better in left field and all the minutiae of it. I mean, he does that with Luis Rojas, the Yankees outfield coach. He just wasn't there. And that's why the Yankees did what they did this offseason and why we're talking about him possibly starting the year in AAA, because his limited defense is part of the reason he's not a good or a perfect candidate for that fourth outfielder role.
And I also think just the construction of the roster doesn't fit Jason. If we were talking about the 2021 Yankees, Jason has an obvious spot there, even if they had a full outfield, because they were very right-handed. This team is very left-handed. I think part of it is roster, kind of where they're at in their timeline. They want to win a World Series. They're trying to contend. They're going to, put that over player development for young guys right now. And then, you know, they are just very left-handed. I think in a world where the Yankees are more right-handed, where certain things fall a different way. They don't get Jazz Chisholm, let's say, and they were a right-handed second baseman or whatever it may be. I don't know. There are worlds where Jason makes sense for the roster. Right now, he's not the best bet for them. And defensively, just a very limited corner outfielder. But as you mentioned, I don't doubt he's a hard worker. And honestly, I think there are double-digit teams in Major League Baseball that would start him in their outfield. Maybe I'm over-exaggerating that, but there are some really bad teams out there. Like, there are some terrible, terrible rosters out there. So I don't know. I think it's more so about where the Yankees are at, where the quality of outfielders at, and where Jason's defense is at, not that he absolutely sucks and will never get any better. Gary, is there any final notes you have in general before we sign off here?
Not really, other than just, yeah, I'm excited to be down there in Tampa. It is the best time of year for reporters because, like I was saying before, it is relaxed. It is a much more mellow vibe. Not only are players more accessible to us, but also coaches, Boone, front office people. I mean, people from all across the organization, various departments. You know, there's people you might see in Tampa every single day that you're down there, and then you don't see them at all for the rest of the season once the real games get started. So it's a really good way for me to, I guess, network is one way of putting it, right? But like, connect with different people in the organization, you know, hear about some things that are going on besides just, you know, what's happening with the 26-man roster or the 40-man roster. You get a sense of what other people besides Boone and Cashman and the major league coaches are thinking about certain players or the organization. It's just, it's a really good time for access. And at the same time, it's just much more relaxed. Like, guys are more willing to talk. You're able to get to know players and coaches and personnel on a more like personable basis. You're able to have more casual conversations. It's if you're a beat writer, it's the best time of year, I think.
And now that, you know, I kind of want to insert my own question here for you, yeah. Gary. So you obviously grew up watching baseball, and you got to experience it from both the fan and now the reporter standpoint. What is the biggest thing you learned going into it as a reporter? Like, what is the biggest gap in perception as a fan to a reporter in terms of what the actual experience is like being on the beat?
I don't know. It's hard for me to like put myself back in that mindset just because I think fans don't understand necessarily like the rapport and the relationship building. I see all the time that fans want us, you know, they want reporters like, you know, get in like a confrontation with Boone or yell a question at somebody, and to them that's holding them accountable. And to me, it's more like kind of we were talking about before, like coming to a point of understanding, why is the organization operating this way? Why does the organization think or feel this way about a certain thing or a certain player? It's not really, you know, in most instances, my place to say, like, this is right, this is wrong. I want to know why it is happening. I want to be able to relay that coherently to readers. I want to also be able to say, like, hey, this is BS when it doesn't make any sense, right? But, like, it's not, I guess it's not, like, coming from a place of personal offense, if that makes any sense. Like, I know fans are living and dying with the team and the decisions they make and the games they win and the games they lose. Like, I think I said this on the last podcast, but like, I'm indifferent towards whether they win or lose. I'm indifferent towards whether Paul Goldschmidt takes more at bats away from Ben Rice, you know, just to use an example from this show. Like, do I think that would be sound baseball strategy if the Yankees were to do that? No. Would I write that it is not sound if they were to do that? Yes. But it's not like I'm going to sit there in a press conference and just hammer the point over and over and over again. It's like, okay, this is what they're telling us. I can write it, and I can either write that it doesn't make sense, or I can, you know, call out and criticize it in that way. I'm not looking to have like a confrontation or a back and forth with anybody because like, to me, it's just, okay, this is what they think, or this is what they're trying to tell fans. I can either relay that point blank, or I can relay that with some analysis and say, like, this doesn't make any sense, or this does make sense, blah, blah, blah. I think fans don't always understand that, you know, we're not coming at it from a place where it's very personal.
And why is that like important for the content you produce and the quality of the content you produce on the article side of things and in your reporting, in your beat reporting, I guess in the entirety of your job?
Well, like, I want to be able to have a relationship with Aaron Boone or Brian Cashman or a player, right? So me getting into some on-camera conflict with them or confrontation with them and going back and forth, like, that doesn't really do anything for anybody. I think it just makes for, you know, a viral TV clip, which personally I don't want anything to do with. That's another thing too. Like, I don't love the whole press conference on camera setting. If I have something that I want to ask Boone about, or he says something that doesn't make sense, and I'm just using him as an example here, where, you know, maybe some follow-ups are required. Maybe, you know, some harder line of questioning is required. I'm going to get more out of that doing it off camera. I'm going to be able to have more of a conversation. I'm going to be able to get more insight, most likely, as well. So, like, it just, I know fans watch the press conferences and they tune into Yes, and they think sometimes maybe that's the end of the conversation. I think we, the beat writers in particular, have much more productive conversations and occasionally get more productive answers and explanations when we're, especially on critical things or sensitive subjects, things like that, when it happens off camera. So just because you didn't hear the question that you wanted in a press conference, or just because you thought, oh, like, that required more and it didn't happen because you didn't see it on camera, that doesn't mean it didn't.
Yeah, and again, these are people at the end of the day. Like, nobody wants nothing. Nobody has ever no one has ever been receptive to being scrutinized and antagonized in a public and broadcasted setting and gone, yeah, you know what, actually, it's cool. I like it. No one likes it. If somebody went up to me at my job while I was editing a video and made a mistake and went, why'd you edit that video wrong? What's wrong with you? I think I'd have a pretty, like, defensive, upset, perhaps never talk to that person again kind of response, which, again, you're trying to tell the story of the season, and you're trying to provide insight. How do you do that without having people to provide the insight to?
And critical questions do happen in the press conference. I know people on social media might want that to happen more often, but they do happen. I just come from the mindset of, if there's going to be follow-ups, or something doesn't make sense, or something requires further explanation, I'm going to have better luck getting that actual explanation privately, opposed to trying for it publicly on camera, and it just becomes a moment, so to speak. Now, that doesn't do anything for me. That doesn't do anything for readers. Probably doesn't do anything for Boone or the player in question or Cashman or whoever it is we're talking about in this situation. Like, I'm probably going to get something more insightful off camera. And that's not even just with controversial or sensitive things. Like, there's been plenty of times where I've written a glowing feature about a player and I asked a question in a press conference and I got a boilerplate, nonchalant answer because, you know, whoever it was just wanted to keep the press conference going or whatever. But then if I ask them privately and I'm like, hey, I'm writing this and I'm really trying to get into their character and who they are off the field, blah, 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 all of a sudden I've got two or three great anecdotes and, like, really detailed stories and colorful quotes. I just always come from the mindset of, if it's not a run-of-the-mill topic, like an injury or something that happened in a game or a roster move, I'm better off doing it off camera. Because I also don't want every other reporter to hear my question or every other reporter to know what I'm writing about or working on or focusing on. So if it's, like, something off the beaten path or something more sensitive, something more critical, like, I'm going to try to do that privately. And more often than not, that's going to get me a better answer than what happens on camera.
You know, again, I just, as a, and I'm not saying I'm the representative of the Yankee fan base, but I am a Yankee fan. So, like, I don't understand these things as in depth or with, I guess, the wherewithal to know how they apply to every day, just trying to get that next article and get and provide the best insight you can in an article. You need those human relationships. And I didn't even think about the angle of just asking guys privately, or even if it's in a critical manner, asking guys privately, or even just the most, or not most run of the mill, but just a run of the mill kind of question about just whatever's going on in terms of relevancy with the team. Gary, go ahead, please.
If a guy is struggling, I'm going to get a better answer out of him as to why he's struggling or what's not working. If I go up to him pregame and say, hey, just so you know, I'm going to write about your slump, or my editor wants a story on why you're struggling. I wanted to talk to you and get your input and your insight before I did that. I'm going to get a better answer, and it's going to be one-on-one. If I do that in a pregame situation where I'm just talking to the guy casually, then, you know, we're all huddled around his locker post-game after he went 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. Hey, what's not working? That they're going to say, you know, I stink right now, and doing my best to figure it out, and 9 out of 10 times it's going to be something run of the mill, and just, that's not insightful.
Yeah, I can't imagine that you're getting. I couldn't understand why someone isn't getting a better answer when you go up to a player after they go 0-for-4 and go, hey, did you feel good about your swing? Did you feel good about your at bats? Actually, I will say this is kind of related, but a little bit off topic. I pitched in a game in high school that was broadcast in our the district broadcasting team. I got crushed. I walked 3 or 4 people in an inning in a third. I didn't strike out anybody. I gave up 4 or 5 runs after the reliever came in and gave up some more runs because I left the bases loaded with no outs. And they wanted to do a mid-game interview, and they wanted to interview the starting pitcher, and they go, how'd you feel about your pitches today? How'd you feel on the mound? Did you feel good? It took a lot to not just go, dude, no, I felt like shit. I was fucking terrible. What's wrong with you guys? Did you watch the game? That's a high school game with zero consequence. I can't even imagine what it's like when you're playing for your spot on the team, or you feel like you're going to get benched or get replaced at the trade deadline, whatever it may be. You don't need to confront these guys for not playing well. They're aware. You don't need to, I don't know. I think there's it just scratches more of an itch for fans, and I think it does serve any purpose at all. And I'll admit, as a fan, there are certain moments where, yeah, there's an itch that I want scratched, but I'm not, you just gotta, let the game result, let it sit with you for, 20 minutes, and then think about what you want in a post-game press conference.
And sometimes those questions have to be asked. Sometimes, yeah, you know, that's what the moment calls for. I'm just talking about, if I have my preference, or if the situation is ideal for me, those tougher questions, tougher conversations, they're going to happen off camera, away from all the lights and the broadcasts and all that. That's not always how it plays out, right? That's not the perfect world. Back in the day, before every team had its own broadcaster, you used to go in the manager's office and ask, that was how the press game or the pregame press conference and the postgame press conference happened. It was just a bunch of reporters, and they talked privately with the manager, and maybe a portion of that was on the record, maybe a portion of that was off the record, but the reporters weren't worried about being on camera. The manager wasn't worried about being on camera. Same thing when you went in the clubhouse. Now it's all very, everything's on TV. Anything can become a moment, right? We've seen the instances where Boone pounds his fists or whatever and gets mad at a question or something like that. I think you're more likely to get something authentic and insightful if you do it away from the camera and away from the press conference. And again, that's not just for the critical stuff or the sensitive stuff. In my experience, that's for most things. If I want a really good story about somebody, a really good anecdote about somebody, I'm more likely to get it privately. And also that helps me because now everybody else doesn't have that anecdote.
Yeah, for sure. And again, I think actually, the New York beat, for the most part, the Yankees beat, I don't know if I've seen any instances where it's like, oh, wow, this guy is just, ripping on Boone for no reason. I think there's a pretty strong general consensus of just good questions, not overstepping out of their guard. I don't get the sense of, oh, they're shilling. I know that's, a thing on Yankee Twitter sometimes, all these guys are just defending Boone and protecting Boone. If you listen to the press conferences, it's pretty impartial. If things are going bad, they're going to ask why things are going bad. If things are going good, they're going to ask about the things that are going good. I think it's just part of being impartial means when fans are generally more displeased, there's a good chance that you're not going to get that kind of reaction from an impartial party on the results. So, Gary, any final thoughts you have before we wrap things here?
No, just got to get this pack and finished up and get down to Tampa.
Yeah, well, let's get you out of here so you can go ahead and do that. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to the third episode of the Bronx Beat. For everybody listening who's liked, subscribed, watched, gave us a 5-star rating, whatever it may be. We really appreciate it. To people who submit questions, thank you all so much. We really appreciate the support, guys. And we'll have this out on both Apple and Spotify for our audio listeners. And of course, you're watching this on YouTube most likely, so it's on the YouTube here as well. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We'll see you guys in the next one. Peace out, everybody.